Oh, good Lord, this is going to be fun.
Hold on to your hat.
So I'm Kimberly Anderson. Welcome to the Sunstone Firesides podcast. I'm with Sondra Mirth in Brentwood, California on May 11th. You know what? Let's back up to the beginning. Okay. Who were your parents growing up? Tell me about your parents.
Well, I was born in England. I was a large child. I think I was just a couple of ounces under a 10-pound baby. And I have a really cool birth certificate from England because it's long and skinny and it's very cool. And that's what my father was in the Air Force. And if I had been born on the base, I would have had an American birth certificate, is my understanding. And I didn't have one of those. I had to become a naturalized citizen when I was 14 or something.
So was the fact that you didn't have a birth certificate and you were an English citizen, did that ever have any, like...
Yes.
Tell me.
I could never be president of the United States. That disturbed me a lot when I was in elementary school.
Did it really?
I thought about that a lot.
So you were somehow perceived internally as less than?
Yes.
Because of that single thing.
Interestingly, it would have been something else. If it hadn't been that, I'm sure I could have found something else too. You know, I was the last of four.
How old were you when you moved to America?
Oh, I was a baby. I was an infant still. I think maybe 6 months old.
So you have no memories.
I have no memories. Yeah.
So you largely were raised as an American girl.
Mm-hmm.
In where were you raised?
I think we initially moved from England back to Texas, San Antonio, where my mom's family was. And then I believe we moved to Kansas for a while. And then to Independence, Missouri.
And why did you move to Independence, Missouri?
Well, it was the center place.
For
the Organized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, of which my father was a minister. But I don't have any memories of him being a minister.
At all?
At all. None.
Did he leave your life? Did he die? Did he pass away? Did he move on in other ways?
Yeah, he walked out. And left my mother with four children under the age of, how old were we? Left with four children under the age of 11 or 12. She was just 30 years old, did not have a high school diploma, had never worked outside of the home, and he left.
Mm.
And I don't believe there was any child support or any financial support from him, and she managed to find a way. And for that, I've always been grateful to my mother for having found a way to keep the roof over our heads, clothes on our backs. They were ugly clothes. They were badly fitting, badly coordinated. I don't know about other people. I knew I was poor. I knew we didn't have anything. I didn't really care, except when it came to food. Apparently, I really wanted more of that. I had an epiphany. I would get up in the middle of the night and go to the kitchen and get something out of the refrigerator in the middle of the night to try it because I was still hungry. Yeah, there was a lot of things lacking. And my mother had to work a lot. So I don't remember seeing my mother in the kitchen cooking. I don't remember my mother doing much of anything. And it was all around the circumstances, man. She had to nose to the grindstone and pull herself up and get out there and find a job. And make it work and keep her children, you know. So I've always thought
about that. What did she do to make ends meet?
She wrapped packages at Christmas time at JCPenney's. Hmm. I remember going with her and sitting underneath the counter. She'd be in this place and people would bring their packages after they finished purchasing them and say, oh, I want that paper. And I can wrap amazing packages. I can, because I would sit there on the floor and just watch her. She was a meter maid at downtown Independence Square. That's how she met my stepdad, gave him a ticket.
Oh, that's okay. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a barber, and she gave him a ticket, and they got introduced to each other. And I am just thankful beyond words that somehow that happened. I don't know how my mom She was making ends meet. She was making a go of it. She's a very strong woman. And I don't know how she ever got into a relationship with my stepdad, because he smoked, he drank, he had been a sailor, so he had kind of a mouth of a sailor occasionally. But he was a sweet, kind-hearted man. And after my father, I'm not sure how much she really liked men at all. So I am forever grateful for whatever happened to make them get together and stay together, because he changed my life. I used to say, and I didn't realize this until many years later, I used to say, because he was married before and had four girls. He married my mom, who had two girls and two boys. My oldest brother was killed in a car accident, and my next brother, who is 2 years older than me, left when he was in high school and went to live with our father. And I started at that moment when I was about 16 years old, 15 years old, saying I was the son he never had. And so I roofed his mom's house with him. I did carpentry work with him. I learned how to turn a lathe. I learned how to change the oil in my car, how to space the spark plugs and do all of that. He taught me so much, and he taught me how to laugh. And I hadn't known laughter before I knew him. I'm still not very good at the fun part and the laughter part, but I don't think I'd be sitting here today if it weren't for him in my life. So I think my mom didn't do a fabulous job of being a mother. I don't remember being mothered by her or cared for by her, but I distinctly remember when I was 12 forgiving her for her lack of, and then fill in the blank, right? She did the best she could with what she had. She didn't have a lot. She grew up very poor. She was the youngest of, I'm going to say 10 kids, but it may have been 11 and it could have been 9. I never can remember. They didn't have anything. They were also members of the RLDS Church. And she has a memory growing up of there being all sorts of people sleeping on their living room floor. They raised these 9 kids in a 2-bedroom, 1 bath, 1,000 square feet maybe, home.
Tiny.
And they always had visitors, because they always took in servicemen that were in San Antonio who didn't have family close by. That's where she met my father. Mm-hmm. She didn't have much of an education. They didn't talk about a lot of things in her family. They didn't talk. They just did. They worked. They were hard workers. So I realized when I was 12 that she couldn't have done any better. She didn't know any better. Right, Maya Angelou? When you know better, you do better. She didn't ever know better. So I think she wanted better. I know she always wanted better for her children. But yeah, I'm forever thankful that she met my stepdad. That changed the trajectory of my life forever. And they met when I was 7 or 8 years old. Mm-hmm. I actually got baptized. We got baptized at the same time, him and I did, at Lake Donovan outside of Independence.
So he converted for your mother?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember, how did he take to life as being a member of the RLDS Church?
He did pretty well. I think probably the hardest part for him was not smoking. He stopped smoking and then took up pipe smoking. Oh my God. I would go with him to the pipe store to pick out tobacco. That was so luscious. That was just, oh my God. And Mom let him do that for a while, and then he finally gave that up. His swearing, you know, he didn't usually do it in front of all of us children. But when him and I were out together, he would let a string of something out when he hit his thumb or something. And so, but I think he did really well. I don't remember he got called to the priesthood. I'm pretty sure he was a deacon for a while. I remember we used to clean the church as a family. We'd go in and on a Saturday night, spend a few hours taking out the trash and sweeping and mopping floors and cleaning bathrooms and things. In what I call the little brown church on the hill, that was the Pleasant Heights congregation in Independence. on 39th Street. We did that for several years. He did really well.
And you loved your father, your stepfather.
My stepdad.
Stepdad.
Mm-hmm. My daddy. He wasn't educated very well either. But he did everything in his power. Keep food on the table. Keep things running smoothly. To this day, that's why we think he died, was because he stopped, because we didn't have very much money, he stopped paying his life insurance policy, and he stopped taking his blood pressure medicine, partly probably because he was stubborn, and partly because we couldn't afford it. So on the day that we were all gathered for my mom's oldest sister, she had died of cancer. We'd had the service, and then we, the day of her burial, we came back to our house, and she had her brothers there, lots of family there. And my stepdad was popping popcorn so people would have something to snack on. And then he said he was going to go downstairs and do some woodworking. And he went downstairs and laid down and died. His heart stopped. It was a blessing that she was not alone. I mean, 24 hours later, she would have been in the house. I had just moved out a few months before. I was a freshman in college, or a sophomore in college, I think. And she would have been all by herself if he had died the next day. We believe that there was some decision on his part, that he knew his health was bad. We didn't go to doctors, so there was some choice in that matter. They were a funny couple. He would tease her and she would get angry with him, and he didn't like crowds, and she would take him to the auditorium for World Conference, and he'd be like, oh my God, I'm just overwhelmed.
Did you enjoy your childhood growing up in RLDS Church?
No.
Was it because of the financial situation, the father situation?
It was the father situation. It was the finances, even though at the time we just had what we had. I wouldn't have known what to do if we had had more, honestly.
Did you see activity in the church as an anchor, as a stabilizing force, as any kind of thing to look to for it, you know, stability in your... Mm-mm. No.
Not really. Not really. I stayed on the periphery, mostly. Totally different experience between me and my sister. Partly because she saw our father do missionary work in England. She always felt like she had a call, but was so saddened for so many years because she knew girls couldn't be in the priesthood. I had no aspiration to that. I had no desire. I didn't find the church to be any more important than going to school or eating or sleeping, or, you know, it was an important part, obviously. But I didn't see it. I saw it totally different when I was a kid.
So the other elephant in the room that's kind of dancing around that we're not even talking about is this idea that you came out. You've mentioned that.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, my coming out story is kind of funny in some regards. When I was married to my second husband, Tony, I was working on Bainbridge Island in Seattle in Puget Sound. And there were a couple lesbian mail carriers. And one of them I was particularly intrigued by. As I realized I was falling in love with her, or having feelings for her, I had to recognize how throughout my life I had events or things that happened when I realized, oh, okay. So for me, it was kind of an awakening of what had always been there. That for circumstances, I didn't allow it to pop up above the surface and recognize it for what it was. And I was really happy in my marriage with Tony. We had just built a wonderful house on 4 acres out in Renton, and I loved him dearly. I still love him dearly. But this woman was just, the attraction was just undeniable. And she didn't want to have anything to do with me. She had been in this situation before where a straight married woman had approached her and they had a fling, and then the woman back to her husband was perfectly happy and wasn't really a lesbian, and she was brokenhearted and left by the wayside. And she was in a relationship at the time that I met her. So, but man, once I met her, there was really no turning back. So when I told my husband, after a couple of weeks of being sneaky and sly and everything, I couldn't stand not telling him the truth, but it was one of the hardest words I ever had to utter, because he is such a kind person. I knew this would hurt him deeply. And the last thing I wanted to do was hurt him. But I also couldn't live a lie. I could no longer deny who I was. And I could no longer live with him without letting him know the truth. And so it was a Saturday night, and we were sitting in our hot tub looking up at the stars. And I told him I had something difficult to tell him. And I said, I've fallen in love with a woman at work. And that I was gay. And he didn't say anything at first. And then he said, well, I guess if she were a guy, I'd have to punch her. And that was kind of it. That was kind of the end of the conversation. Interestingly enough, we got up the next morning and did what we always do on Sunday morning. We went to church. Just so happened that that morning was the most conservative speaker speaking at our congregation in Seattle. And I looked it up later. I can't remember right now where it's from, but it's the 10, he called it the 10 reasons why you're going to go to hell.
I'm sorry. Perfect timing, right?
Yes. I had been out of the closet for less than 12 hours.
In Mormonism, we have a phrase called tender mercies.
Yes.
That was like the opposite of a tender mercy.
Yes. And a big club smack you over the head. And as I sat there and listened to him, you know, you're going to go to hell if you've had an abortion. And I thought, okay, well, I took that girlfriend in high school to Planned Parenthood. I don't think she had an abortion, but I was kind of all for it. I mean, if she needed to, you're going to go to hell if you commit adultery. Ooh, yeah, I've kind of recently done that. Okay, but not with a guy. I wonder if that counts. So I had this unusual conversation in my head as he was going through the 10 reasons why you're going to go to hell. And then he said, got to the, you're going to go to hell if you're gay. I thought, oh, well, now that's it.
Finally, you had a nail you could hang your hat on.
Yes, exactly. Ah, that's me. That's the one. Okay, well, now we're sure.
If in doubt.
Yeah, we're going to hell. The other ones were but that was a good one. And that was the last time I went to church for 10 years that day. I went back one more time to that building because one of the older ladies died and wanted me to sing at her memorial. Mm-hmm. And I promised I would. And I went back into that building very hard to do after 6 or 7 years, and I sang at her memorial service, and no one spoke to me. Now, they had no idea why I left. I never told them I left because I was gay. But they never talked to me. They never said, hey, where you been? What you been doing? What's up? They just let me go. Like I didn't matter in their world. And I was like, well, If I don't matter in your world, you don't matter in mine. Goodbye. So I just stayed away for about 10 years.
So your LDS, I'm sorry, your RLDS tradition mm-hmm. also includes a space for the homosexual person, the gay person, the lesbian person.
Yes.
And that space is one of sin, abhorrence, a deviant behavior. This is all stuff from the Old Testament, I'm presuming, because that's mm-hmm. that's the framework that I grew up in within mm-hmm. Salt Lake City-based Mormonism.
Yeah.
Is that was the rationale for the RLDS stance on homosexuality?
Well, back in the day, yeah. I think that's where it must have come from.
Yeah.
Growing up and when I got with my first girlfriend and recounted things that I remembered from my childhood, you know, crushes I had on neighborhood girls and my gym teacher. Oh my God. And, being with girlfriends at high school and they say, oh, what's your favorite body part? Oh, I just love eyes. Don't you just love to look in a boy's eyes? And someone say, oh, but I love really big biceps, you know, strong arms, you know, and all that. And I thought, ooh, boobs. Oh, no, chest. Oh, gosh. We're talking boys. Darn. Okay. You know, so.
And this is all internal.
Oh, all internal.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Never say any of this stuff out loud. So, The funny part about my coming out story was that, so I stopped going to church and I really stopped talking to anybody in my family because I just stop. And, stayed in touch with my sister. I mean, she lived relatively close. We lived within 20 minutes of each other or something. But my brother still lived in Missouri. And he, Sunday morning, now the tradition is not to go to church, but to lay in bed with my girlfriend and watch football. Mm. And preferably, I don't know, can I say this? Have sex while people are cheering on, the fans are cheering the football team. It's really great. And, you just like believe that people are cheering you on.
Some positive affirmations for your lesbian relationship.
I know, right? Wonderful. So anyway, my brother called me one Sunday morning and said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I said, what? And he goes, Mom, you haven't talked to Mom. When's the last time you talked to Mom? I said, I don't want to talk to her. No, you have to talk to Mom. And I said, well, what is up? And he goes, it's your story, and I know it's your story, and I didn't mean to say anything, but Mom was just going on and on about how she hadn't talked to you in so long, and she was convinced you were dying. And so I just, I'm so sorry. This is not the way I wanted it. But I told, you know, Mom, she's not dying. She's just gay. And he felt so bad because he goes, it's not my story and I wasn't supposed to tell. And I know you wanted to have a conversation with her first, but she just would not stop with you were dying because she just hadn't heard from you. And so I called her up and said, Mom, I'm just fine. I'm just gay. Oh my goodness, what did I do wrong? You did nothing wrong. Mm. You did nothing wrong. I've always been gay. This is the way God made me. It's just what happened. And I'm fine. And so that my brother, I forgave him. It's okay. I don't know if I would have. I wasn't excited to tell anyone. I didn't care to tell anybody. You don't know. You don't know. You don't. Yeah. And a real. Yeah. So. But
how does she respond?
Interestingly, my mom and I have always had a rather tumultuous relationship. Fascinating, as we started talking, she goes, oh my God, now this explains everything. This explains why you would not stay in a dress. You would not keep your little cute patent leather shoes on. I would get you all dressed for church, and I'd turn to pay attention to one of your siblings, and I'd come back, and you were undressed again. And you would not stay. And you hated frilly things. You hated lacy things. You would not put on those little white gloves for Easter and a little hat. And she, oh my God. And she says to me, all I wanted was my little baby girl. And I realized what a huge disappointment I had been to her without knowing. I mean, we just fought. I didn't know why we were always fighting. And then I realized it was because I was not the little baby girl that she had imagined she would have. She wanted, you know, four children. She just wanted one more little girl. Kay was the oldest, then my two brothers, and then me. And she just wanted a little girl. She could dress up in little girl things, and little pink things, and little frilly things. And I wanted none of it ever from the very beginning. And it was interesting that she had this recollection in our conversation and totally, and then we went through and explained years of arguments. And now by coming out, suddenly, oh, well, okay, now, okay, we're good. And it was the weirdest. If I couldn't imagine it ever going that way. I couldn't ever imagine it healing what had always been broken between us.
But yeah. You felt it was a healing of your past?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Was it as if things had been forgotten or things had been forgiven?
Things had definitely been forgiven. Yeah. Because I don't have many positive memories of my childhood. I've seen pictures and I have a smile on my face, so I know they've happened. But if I didn't have the picture,
there's no proof of happiness in your childhood.
No proof
inside your own head.
So there was a lot of conflict between my mom and I, and by coming out, I mean, yeah, it was amazing. So yeah.
Did you feel growing up, I mean, as you kind of look back and put a lot of these things into context and understanding of who you were and the environment, the culture that you were raised in the RLDS church, did you see or do you feel now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you feel that the inability to speak and have language in any conversation about sexuality or identity, did that keep you hidden even to yourself perhaps?
Yes. My sister and I talked about this. Growing up, we didn't have a word. We didn't know the word lesbian. We didn't have any positive, certainly no positive words for being gay. Every word we ever heard, and it was only the occasional word, was always bad, in a bad connotation, right? So it was difficult to figure it out. Because I had no language to put to it, except I knew immediately when not to speak up that I had a crush on the girl next door. I knew that was probably not appropriate.
The body parts conversation.
Yeah, the body parts conversation, yeah.
Thank you for sharing about your mother.
You're welcome.
And about your father.
You mean my dad?
Thank you. Your daddy.
Yeah.
You called him daddy.
I miss him. Miss him a lot. Yeah, the church didn't have that much significance in my growing up, except it was the one steady thing that was always there. Wallace B. Smith, who was president and prophet of our church, was my eye doctor.
Oh, interesting. We
call him Wally B. He was my eye doctor before he became president and prophet of the church. Everything, I mean, you grew up, Bud Sheehy was one of the 12 apostles for years. His daughter Lisa and I were in youth groups together, and I remember being over at their house and his standing joke, which was somewhat risque back in the day, in the 60s and 70s, was, do you know why my mom sent me to college? And he would say, to make Budweiser and beer. Oh, and he was an apostle. It was like, oh, did he just say the name of a beer? Oh my gosh. Yeah, it was different. It was different because we just ran in those circles with the hierarchy, with and they were just our pals, you know, they were our neighbors.
At what point did you realize that that was kind of a special way to grow up?
I'm not sure I ever thought of it as special.
And now?
Kind of, but I still have some of those odd close relationships for one reason or another.
It's just the way it was growing up.
Yeah.
These are your friends and your friends' parents.
And so I don't put them on these pedestals of, ooh, that's the president and prophet of the church. You don't talk to them. So I was away from the church for 10 years. When I came back, the first thing I came back to was GALA, the Gay and Lesbian Association, a name that we're not really happy with, and I think they're in the process of changing it, but when it was formed back in the 80s, gays and lesbians was kind of all that there was, right? Right. There were no bisexual or transgender people back then, right? Okay, so we were just looking to band together a group of people that were members of Community Christ who felt the angst of not being fully included, who felt as if their spiritual life wasn't being able to be fully explored. We couldn't be, if we were out at church, if people knew we were gay, we couldn't become priesthood members back in the 80s and 90s. And so.
Were you excommunicated?
No.
There was no process for excommunication?
No. You had to do something very terrible.
Relationship? Sex?
I don't think so. I don't think they excommunicated anyone just on the basis of being in a relationship. I do know that for the men who were priesthood members, once they came out, their priesthood cards were revoked. They were taken.
So the literal card was given.
Yeah. Yeah. And their license.
And it was taken back.
And it was taken back. And there were some terrible stories around those, the way that was done. It was not done in a compassionate, loving way at all. And so it ostracized all of them from the church and created some really harsh, bad feelings, and appropriately so.
Well, what happened to these men when their priesthood was taken away?
Many of them left. Some of them just stayed in the background. Some of them just hang out in the, you know, in the shadows, if you will. I don't know.
Their families?
Their families were fine. They weren't gay.
Just the men, just, or the gay person was shunned.
It was a lot like being shunned, you know.
And I said that I didn't put that word in your mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like that. You know, you weren't as involved anymore. You weren't asked to do things. I know a lesbian friend of mine in Michigan, when she came out, I think they knew she was gay. Let me see if I can get this story. It's been a while since I've heard it. Maybe it's when she got into a relationship with another church member, a woman. I believe she was teaching Sunday school class. I can't remember if she, no, she didn't have, she wasn't a member of the priesthood. They were so appalled when she came out that they told her to her face that she was not good enough to even clean the church, much less teach a Sunday school class. She hung on, you know, she hung
on.
Her and her partner, I married them several years ago when it became part of the national conference that they would be recognized in the church. I flew up to Michigan and married them.
What an incredible story of perseverance and patience and forgiveness.
Yeah. Now her and her partner and their three girls are like the cornerstone of the little congregation in the little town in Michigan that they live.
You know, that's such an interesting comparison and contrast to my Mormon tradition, that these people that really have wanted to stay within the church and raise their kids and have a strong family with two dads or two moms, or not even have kids and just be married in the church, they don't have that opportunity, even if they really, truly want it. But in your faith community, not only do they get that chance, but they thrive and excel and contribute. Cornerstone. You said Cornerstone.
Yeah, it's amazing. The differences are amazing. I know that when I was first called to the office of priest, it was before National Conference. So I was gay. Everybody knew I was a lesbian. And I had a call to the office of priest. Once you get told that, you have the opportunity to accept or deny. You can choose to not accept the calling. In my case, it happened right before National Conference. So National Conference is when a subset of the world church got together and decided to fully include LGBT people in the ability to be in the priesthood, to be married, to be active participants in every aspect of the church. So I got my call right the year before that happened. And I was asked to speak at, we were at a retreat, our mission center, large area of northern, all of Northern California. Representatives for most of our congregations were at Happy Valley Conference Center. And we were actually learning about the voting devices that were going to be at the national conference. So we were running through some skills for that. And the Mission Center president at the time asked me if I wanted to speak and share my story about my priesthood call. And I thought, oh man, I'm really an introvert, and speaking in front of all those people about something so very personal, I wasn't sure I was clear. I wanted my story to be known, but could someone else please tell it for me? I'm not sure I'm up for this. This is asking me to go way outside my comfort zone. And so the time allotted to do this, I could see kind of tick, tick, ticking away. And suddenly, I just stood up. And he was starting the sentence of saying, okay, we're going to wrap up now. And I just stood up. And thank God I was right near him and he could see. I stood up and he knew, because he had asked me to speak and say something, but my mouth was not working. But I knew I could get my body. I knew I could get up on my feet. I'm gonna speak now. Not sure what I'm gonna say.
And nothing came out.
And nothing really. And so I had to find the words. And he stopped. And he goes, "Oh, Sandra's gonna share with us." I was like, "Hi, I'm Sandra." I mean, everybody knew me. What I ended up saying was that I struggled with accepting my priesthood call. I had been in a relationship with a woman who was also a church member, and we lived locally, and we raised her youngest son from her first marriage. Everyone knew her. They knew we had been together. They knew we broke up. I'm sure some of them figured maybe I had been married to a man at some point and divorced. But I said in this, speaking to them, you know, I've been in and out of two long-term lesbian relationships. I've been married to a man. I don't think I mentioned the first guy again. But I've been married to a man and divorced.
It's our secret. We won't tell anybody.
We won't. And somehow, because I'm not currently in a relationship with a woman, I fit the rules of I can be called to the priesthood.
Because regardless of past behavior, relationships, etc.
Yeah. So there was part of the rule around being LGBT that you could be called to the priesthood so long as you weren't having sex. And that would be known to them by being in a relationship with someone, right?
So wait a minute. They equated sexual activity with being in a relationship.
Yes. Little do they know.
Don't they know? Okay. All right. All right.
All right.
I slapped my forehead on then. Yeah.
So, so I said, so here I am, this person who obviously hasn't figured out the relationship thing at all, compared to my good friend Scott, who is now the pastor of the San Francisco congregation,
I love Scott.
Partner, Christopher, have been together now 27 years. And because they've been in this monogamous, long-term, loving relationship, he can't be called to the priesthood, but I can because I have so messed up that I can. I said, it doesn't make sense to me how that is.
And so that was your struggle.
Yeah, that was my struggle.
The hypocrisy, the double standard.
Yes. I have real issue with double standards and hypocrisy. If there's going to be a rule, it needs to be evenly applied to people of all races, genders, socioeconomic. You can't pick and choose. Okay, so if you can't equally apply it to all these different types and categories of people, maybe there shouldn't be a rule. Maybe you have to take the painful amount of time it takes to look at each individual situation on its own merit.
So ultimately, you had to reconcile all this with your church. How did that go around?
Well, I accepted the call to priest, and it was fine. It was odd. That was 6 years ago. Was that 9 years ago? I'm trying to remember which conference. 6 years ago.
So you accepted your call to the priesthood.
Yeah. And then I offered to serve communion at World Conference 6 years ago. And the wrinkle in that story is I was told by my doctors at the time that that would be the last World Conference I would be alive for. So I thought to myself, if I'm going to be a priesthood member, I always thought as a kid watching this gathering of thousands of people and sharing the communion meal, how special that was, that I should do that. I should serve in that way, thinking it might be my last. It's a very special time. So obviously it wasn't, because that was 6 years ago. We have conferences every 3 years now. Those set of doctors I fired because I didn't like what they had to say.
And your expiration date has come and gone.
It has come and gone, and is now as much unknown as everyone else's expiration date, which I like.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is.
We have to live every day at the fullest, right?
I know.
The carpe diem times a billion.
Yes. But in the process of all of that, I remember that conference because I got to be with Ron Harmon, who is one of the 12 apostles. And if you're familiar, have you ever been in the auditorium in Independence?
No.
It's this huge thing they built in the 40s, I believe, 30s and 40s. It took a long time to finish building it. And he took me on this wonderful personal tour, just him and I, and got to go and see where the very first bricks were ever laid for the foundation. There's still a place where you can actually visually see those.
Oh, that's kind of fun.
And then in the auditorium, you know, it has this dome ceiling. I wish I had this picture. And it has this oval opening. And as a child, you believe that Jesus is going to come down through that opening. Like it's mimics like a skylight, but it's not, obviously. I mean,
were there stories about that? Were there faith-promoting rumors about that? Or was it just kind of a fanciful idea that kids had?
I think it was a little fancy, a little rumor, a little everything mixed into one.
Right.
But I always thought that was such a cool place. Way up in the dome, you can go up in there. And when I found that out, he took me up in there.
Oh, the place where you thought Jesus was going to come down from, right?
Yes. And it's so cool because you kind of have to walk through these rafters and on these 6x2x6s through, you know, it was just so cool. And then you have to crawl down and crawled down through and under this little opening to get to the walkway that circles
the oval. Perfectly safe for children.
Yes. But anyway, It was very cool. And I got up there and the acoustics are wow. So he got me up there. And of course, I started singing because I wanted to hear. I very quietly sang.
How'd that sound?
Oh, it was marvelous.
What did you sing?
I think I sang one of the songs in the new hymnal called I'm Gonna Live So God Can Use Me.
How's it go?
I'm gonna live so God can use me every every day. I'm gonna live so God can use me anytime and anywhere. I'm gonna sing so God can use me anytime and anywhere. I'm gonna sing so God can use me anytime and anywhere. Yeah. It was great.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile. But most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temple recommend if you want.
Yeah, so I came back to the church through a gala retreat after being away for 10 years. And it was funny, the first retreat was held up that I went to in 2000 was held at Lake Sammamish. No, Sammamish. In Washington, yeah, north of Seattle. Mm-hmm. I think that's the place. And I thought it was just going to be gay people that were church members. And there were straight people there.
Yeah.
What the hell are they doing at my retreat?
They're crashing your party.
I know.
Straight people.
They're damn
the worst.
Them.
Straight people.
How dare they? Good grief. They're just everywhere.
The nerve.
The nerve of them. I was so angry that retreat. I don't know why anyone spoke to me ever that weekend.
You're just mad.
I was just so
stomping
mad.
Stomping around.
I was.
Mad little gay girl. Stomp. Damn.
Oh my gosh. It was terrible. So I started looking at gala as a possible way to enter back into the church and got involved with gala. And became a board member after a few years.
Is gala still in existence?
It is.
So I served as the vice president of affirmation mm-hmm. for the first half of 2018. We never mentioned gala. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah.
I didn't know it existed, Sandra, till you mentioned it earlier today.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a lot of our own people don't know it exists, partly because we had to be really quiet.
Mm. Was it church sanctioned?
Well, now that's a tricky question. You'd have to ask the legal department. No, it was not church sanctioned per se. We were technically never an affiliate of the church. They could never recognize us as a group associated with the church. We had to be careful in anything that we published, exactly how we spoke of mm-hmm. Community of Christ, so as there was no confusion or more confusion, however you saw that.
Did you get any money from the church?
No, gosh, no. No, never.
Would you have taken it if it was offered?
Probably not. Maybe. We didn't ever have very much money. I was fine with that. So I got on the gala board. I had started going back to church as a board member.
And by now the culture of the church is women have the priesthood.
Women have the priesthood, and that's as far as we've gotten.
Okay.
And I met with some of the apostles of the church and the first presidency, and kind of felt like old home week. New faces and names.
Because you knew these people.
Cause, well, it was new people.
Oh, okay.
But
that's
it was
right, yeah.
Familiar to me. I didn't, because that had been my norm growing up, I felt like I could speak my mind carefully. but I didn't hold them in high esteem, maybe, as other people did, or I didn't see them as the authority figures that they were and are. I wasn't really into giving anybody any more power over me than what they might have naturally, you know? So I wasn't going to actively give them more by putting them on a pedestal. So,
do you feel that they sensed that as disrespect?
They could have.
Did you get any kind of a feedback from them that no?
Mm-hmm. So Ron Harmon was our go-between. Gala kind of had an apostle assigned to them. So if we had issues that we wanted to be brought to the first presidency or wanted discussed amongst in their meetings or something, we would go to him and say, these are our concerns.
So, wow. Having served as the vice president for Affirmation, I mean, I knew that there was communication between public affairs and Affirmation, between the Mormon Church and mm-hmm. Affirmation. And some of that communication is, you know, quite free and quite open. But for us to have the ear of an apostle mm-hmm. would have been, I mean, that does happen on occasion. Mm-hmm. Very, very rarely.
Yeah.
But you had that.
It's a given.
Yeah.
It's a given.
And why was it a given? They felt important.
I wondered if sometimes they wanted to keep an eye on us. Make sure we don't go too far afield. But mostly, my relationship with Ron was such a godsend. For instance, when I was called to the office of priest, when we scheduled my my confirmation, I'm sure it has an official name that is escaping me at this moment.
Darn it.
In San Francisco, I asked Ron if he couldn't be there. And he lived in Independence. Now, when I think back, I was like, who are you that thinks she can ask one of the apostles to pick up and come out to San Francisco for a weekend just because I'm getting ordained? That was the relationship we had developed. And part of it was I really wanted him to be there. Turned out to be his anniversary. And he promptly made reservations and surprised his wife with a long weekend in San Francisco for their anniversary. And
this.
He attended.
He came to your confirmation.
I mean, where, when, in what world does it happen that a lesbian woman gets called to the priesthood and she just boldly asks one of the 12 apostles to show up and he does?
Not in the Mormonism I grew up in.
Yeah. I mean, so that's seems like a continuation of my childhood with Wally B as my eye doctor and that sort of thing. So we navigated some difficult areas. I became gala president after David Howard died suddenly. We were to meet for our yearly board meeting, and just hours before he was to get on the plane, he went to the clinic. He wasn't feeling well or something, and he died, I believe, of an aortic aneurysm. He had been talking to me for a few months about becoming vice president. We didn't have a vice president role at the time on the gala board, but he kind of wanted me to be his vice president. He wanted to kind of groom me to take over gala. And I kept on saying, you know, we'll talk about it when we get to the board meeting. And then he died. And at the board meeting, we had a little service, private service amongst the seven or eight of us, and said, now we need to elect a new president. And a couple of guys spoke up, yeah, I feel like, you know, I live here in Independence. I feel like I could do this. And another guy speaks up and, oh, you know, I'm friends with most of the first presidency and, you know, I know inner workings and all this other stuff. And then I said, I don't want to talk, because I knew I had to talk, but I didn't want to talk. And it wasn't a thing like the time before where I could stand up and my standing up would indicate I needed to talk. And I said, I feel like I've been called to do this. I don't know why. I don't know. I have no idea that I'm prepared to do this, but I feel like it's something I am uniquely qualified to do. And this was before National Conference. We were just about ready to publish a second book called, I'm not going to tell you what it's called. I'll think of it later.
suspense is
key. Yes. It was just at the stage to get published, and it was David's dream.
Oh, and he passed away before it was published.
Yes. Gathering stories of LGBT members of Community of Christ and their stories.
Has it been published?
Yeah, so it was published. Grace is in the title.
Is it a thick anthology? Is it a large volume?
No. So I became president, and Ron and I became even tighter because navigating the waters before National Conference and making sure things happened as they should in gala and nobody went off. I don't know. It was a difficult time.
Did you feel this was ramping up or preparing church for something really big?
Yes.
Did you feel that weight?
Yes.
How did you handle that? How did you work with that?
One foot in front of the other.
Did you realize that you were setting stones in place to be forming policy and direction for
hoping.
The church? Yeah.
I was hoping that that's what was happening, but prepared to be totally... I'm really big on setting you're disappointed, you need to lower your expectations. It's not something I did to disappoint you. Your expectations were too high. So I was constantly readjusting my expectations of what was going to happen or what could become of this. We had decided that as a group, we wanted to try the year before National Conference to go out amongst the United States to the camps and reunions and gatherings of the saints to get opportunities to tell our story, to put a face to the issue at hand. And so...
You were campaigning.
Yeah, we were basically campaigning. And so we did that. And I did that for a couple of different groups up in the Seattle area because I had a connection with them and here in California. So,
You made an impact.
Yeah, I think we did. Then we had, we had World Conference, and then once that was over, started National Conference. So during World Conference, I got to tell you the story about Joe the napkin guy. We had a booth. We couldn't have our own booth as gala because they wouldn't let us. We had to have a share booth space with the diversity team, which includes the first peoples of everywhere and races of every kind and then us. And so we had our book that had now been published and one of the members bought a couple hundred copies so that we could give them out at World Conference. And we had pens that you write with. Oh, here's one.
Are you serious?
No, it's not. This is my elder. That says, for everyone, a place at the table.
Oh, I love
on it,
that
we gave away. And we talked to people. And we did that. And then the booths shut down and we had National Conference. So during one of these times, we had baskets of these pens sitting on the table and people would come by and grab two or three. And under the clip was a business card and it had gala information on one side of the business card and WCN, Welcoming Community Network, on the other side. And they would take our card and hopefully they'd say something or we'd have an opportunity to talk to them, or they just take the pen. And so this rather old gentleman comes and takes a pen one day and walks off and comes back the next day and the basket's empty. Oh, I was hoping to get a pen for my wife. And I said, oh, we just ran out today. I'll make sure we have some tomorrow if you come by. Are you going to be here tomorrow? And he goes, yeah, I'm working in the Laurel Club. And so the Laurel Club is the dining hall in the auditorium, in the lower space of the auditorium. I found out later that Joe had so many physical and health issues that the only thing he could do was hand out napkins. So you go through the line, he couldn't serve anything because he didn't have strength in his arms anymore or hands to hold a ladle. He couldn't fill drinks because he couldn't pick up the pitcher. He couldn't walk and clean up tables very much because he wasn't terribly stable moving. He couldn't see very well, but he could stand there. And as people, and as this, you know, I could imagine with his limited eyesight, maybe he could just see a glob pass by. He could hand out a napkin. He wanted to volunteer so badly at the age of 80-something that he was willing to stand there during mealtimes and hand out napkins. He wanted to serve his church so badly that that's what he did. And so the next day when he came back to the booth to get a pen for his wife, he comes back, and I'm actually under the table. I don't see him coming. I'm under the table collecting the trash and organizing things. And again, the basket is empty. And he says, oh my gosh, you don't have any pens. I was going to get one for my wife. And I said, Joe, is that you? And I pop up from underneath the table. And I said, I saved your wife a pen. And he tears up. You remember me? Well, of course I do, Joe. You said yesterday you wanted to get your wife one because she'd really like the stylus thing. So I saved one for your wife. And I gave it to him and I hugged him and I went about my business. The next day, we were starting national conference. One of the ladies from the congregation here in Northern California, Sandra, I've got to talk to you. Come here. I got to talk to you. Joe is my brother. Like my sibling brother, just not my brother in Christ, but he's my brother. And I'm staying at his house. And he told me this wonderful story of getting a pen and that you saved him a pen for his wife and that you remembered him and you gave him a pen and you hugged him. You're the first gay person he's ever met. And this whole issue about including LGBT in the priesthood and fully including them in the church, in the life of the church, he was like, yeah, do we really need to do this? I don't understand what the big deal is. I mean, who are they? I don't think I need to vote. I don't know. You saved him that pen. And now all he wants to do is say how great gay people are. Sometimes that's all it takes, is to just be compassionate and understanding of all those straight people out there who sometimes get on my nerves and annoy me, and have an understanding and be a human. I mean, I was just being thoughtful, but he didn't have any context for LGBT. He doesn't know what all those letters stand for.
Right.
So that's Joe the napkin guy.
So I said earlier that straight people are the worst. They're actually not.
They're not.
I love many straight people.
I have many friends who are straight.
I have a lot of friends who are straight too. Hey, do you know? Joe, the napkin guy. Yeah. That's an amazing story. So you were, I mean, we can look back and we can say, yeah, you were involved in changing the tide, changing
The organization was really involved in it, Gala. I mean, if it hadn't been for them coming together as a group in the early 80s and like holding, it was like they held the candle. They kept the candle burning. many people went away and went to other denominations and did other things and stopped going altogether. But there was always someone that kept the candle lit and the hope of being fully inclusive alive.
So speaking with Kay, she told me the mechanism in place, or that the procedure that happened, the process that happened, that vote that was cast to decide, the members decided. And I got to tell you, I've worked with lots and lots and lots of true believing members. And by and large, the members are ready. Mm-hmm. But I don't see, and this is the difference in the story from the community of Christ to Mormonism, is I don't think that there's a leadership humility in Mormonism that's willing to let the members at large create that culture of inclusion.
Yeah.
They can do it on an individual basis, have friends, extend love, charity, kindness, mm-hmm. financial support. I've benefited from many, many, many beautiful people that have done that for me.
Yeah.
And I know that that's possible within an individual level, on a local, small level. I don't, and maybe this is the cynic in me, I don't see that there's a willingness from the church leadership, that core, mm-hmm. to be willing to say, hey, let's listen to some people for a minute,
yeah.
and let's see what can happen. Instead, we hear the opposite. We hear doubling down, tripling down, hateful, mm-hmm. exclusionary language. Mm-hmm. So
to me, it starts with diversity on whatever level you can get it. And for us, it was having women being included. I mean, they took the big hit back in the 80s of how the church included women in the priesthood. That was handled poorly at best. A lot of membership was lost. There was not a lot of discussion. And because of the trials that women went through in our faith journey, made a huge difference to how well this was going to turn out. Partly because the leadership looked back at how that decision was handled and held and decided they could have done a lot better. They could have had more discussion, and they didn't. And so they didn't want to do that again. So there was a lot of retrospection. The other thing was that now we had women that were part of the First Presidency. And we had people of color, and there was diversity on another level included in the hierarchy of our church. And because they had been willing to look at some level of diversity, then they were able to take it further. And I, being totally removed from Mormonism, I look at it and I see an old white guy's church. And so long as it remains at that level, then it can't. I don't see how it could possibly go to the next step.
Tell me what you're working on now.
Now I am working on developing a workshop to help train youth camp counselors and directors on how to be more inclusive of the LGBTQ community.
Before you jump into telling us what you do, I'm really super curious what these camps look like. What do these camps look like?
Oh, gosh. Community of Christ is really, really good at holding camps. They typically divide it by age groups. So you have your junior high, your senior high, your youth, pre-junior high. We have camps for people who are, I'm going to use the word disadvantaged. Financially struggling, that are unable to pay. I think it's called Camp Opportunity. I don't know if it's strictly, I think it's a socioeconomic kind of combination of things. So And camps for youth are typically where a child will be able to define their first God moment, that they have some of their first connections with their spirituality and the spirit, and it can be amazing, amazing time in their life. And it's a time to have campfires and sing and do skits and do silly things, but it's also a time to tap into their spirituality. And a lot of times, camps enable children to have their first God moment that they can recognize and explain,
put words around. What's a God moment?
An encounter with the divine. The one that comes to my mind was most recently when I was in San Francisco and I was scrubbing the bathtub in the church, and I was trying to get those silly little adhesive plastic butterflies off the bottom. And I was scrubbing and scrubbing and scrubbing on my hands and knees and scrubbing and scrubbing. And it was as if I heard the voice of God in that moment. And in that moment of being on my hands and knees in the church, it was as if I heard a voice that said, "You're ready. You know, you're ready for this." And I can't remember exactly now how it went. I just remember being overwhelmed, and I started crying as I was scrubbing the bathtub. I think a part of me believes there is something very sacred about being on your knees, which now that I have two bad knees and one bad hip, I can't do anymore. That, what is it, supplication? That getting on your knees and recognizing a higher power is pretty incredible and awesome. And it's those kind of moments the kids can have. There's opportunities for them to have quiet time and have space, and there's activities that are designed around perhaps a theme for the week. They work together. They have team building exercises. Do different stuff. Be kids. Be allowed to be kids.
How should we end this? What's left to talk about? Personal goals. You've got some. I mean, I don't want to make this too personal, but we've cried 3 or 4 times.
Yeah. I want to retire from the current job I hold, my 40-hour a week, sometimes 60. I want to retire when I'm 70. Yeah, my goal would be to do this workshop, take it to the center place, take it to Independence, and then start training trainers, teach other people to do this workshop. So it goes even further. And maybe it's not just about LGBT. Maybe it's about all the marginalized youth, right?
So let's look back in time. Did little Sandra have any idea that any of this was possible?
No. Nope. I had no great dreams to do anything. Had no aspirations. Just wanted to be a contributing member of society. This really was my goal. Not to get a degree, certainly not to be the center of any attention whatsoever, which this is, which is making me go a little crazy inside. And I sing, and I would love to sing more, but I get really anxious around being a soloist, because I mean, the spotlight is really on you.
That's why you're the soloist.
Soloist. Somewhere in there, I'm sure, is. And it's very difficult.
So a group of soloists, just so we're clear, a group of soloists is called a choir?
Yeah, did that.
Yeah, okay.
Did that. And even in a choir of 80 people, I would still throw up before we performed a lot of times.
Performance anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was anything near being on stage, literally or figuratively, used to make me very, very anxious. Didn't think I was worthy. What did you say? It's the imposter syndrome. So when I'm doing this training, I'm very clear to everyone in the room. I am not an expert on this. I do not have all the knowledge on this. Just because I'm a lesbian and just because I'm a member of Community of Christ doesn't mean I, you know, have cornered the market on what we need to do. Just means I'm really concerned about this issue, and I think we can do better. And if we can do better, then I want us to do better.
You might not be a, quote, expert, but you're certainly far beyond good enough.
Yeah. And that was really all I was ever striving for, was just to be good enough. Just to, please just let me get by. Please let me get by without getting noticed too much. Good or bad noticed. Yeah. I didn't really care. You know, so yeah.
Well, thank you for letting me notice you.
Thank you for noticing. It's been fun.
This has been quite a day.
Yes, it has.
You know, and honestly, I was glad that I did kind of think, yeah, I need to interview Sandra. She's got something to share.
Yeah.
And I'm so, so, so glad you did. It's easy to sit in the background. Mm-hmm. It's easy to sit in the shadow with such a powerful figure as your sister.
Yeah.
My admonition, there, I'll use a Mormon word, to you is not to do that.
Yeah.
When it's comfortable and when it's safe.
Yeah.
When you're ready.
Yeah.
And you step up, you step forward.
Yeah.
But don't automatically assume that everyone's here to see the Kay show.
Yes.
Because there are many times
yeah.
that people are here to see the Sandra show.
Funny story, 6 years ago at World Conference, we're all lined up to get lunch or something. And there's hundreds of people lined up on this ramp. You know, we're going and you can kind of look up and see the lines and groups of people. And someone is coming down the ramp. Hey, hey. And I forget what they said, hey, whomever. But I thought they were looking for the guy behind me, because the guy behind me used to be the church historian. Very well-known, loved Richard Howard, loved man. And I thought, oh, they're going for him. And they came up to me and said, Sandra, I wanted to talk to you. I was like, who, me? And I keep that as a reminder in the forefront of my brain every now and then that I do have something important to share, and I do have something valuable to give, and that I need to not keep hiding behind whatever dialogue goes in my head sometimes, this silliness about not being good enough and not being capable or whatever it is that pops up, and not allowing those self-deprecating conversations to go on long. I mean, they come up, they pop up, and it's like, ah, I see you. Don't think I don't see you hiding there in that dark corner. I got you.
That's right.
Now you have to leave. I'm going to shine a light on you. I hear you, and now you have to go. Until next time, bye.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is great.